quotations for living. Many people have said many things about many subjects, but we're considering today some of the things that people of the past have said about how one should live, how one does live. Some of you may have read some of the novels by Dorothy Sayers, in which you will read about Lord Peter Wimsey, who could settle any problem that was arising in Britain at that time. And one time, Lord Peter Wimsey said, "I have a quotation for every occasion. It saves original thinking." And so there's always something that somebody has said about almost every topic. You know that the New Testament writers quote frequently from the Old Testament. The hymn that was sung at the end of the First Communion, remember they sang a hymn and then they went out, was Psalm 118. And in that it speaks about the rock, and that's quoted at least three times in the New Testament. So some of the important sayings of the past are now and then quoted in the present. There was a book about preaching years ago, and one of the things it said was, if you want to be quoted, you must quote. So we're going to consider how to live today, as various people have commented upon it. Schools, of course, prepare us for life, and then we have to learn how to make a living afterward. And, of course, some of the things that we learned in school may have helped us to make our living. Brother Graves quoted A.W. Tozer, who was very famous for making statements that were highly significant. And he said one time, "I'm a little too old to know all the answers," but he knew many of them. Brother Graves also quoted Psalm 27, "One thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, that I may behold the beauty of the Lord and inquire in his temple." And one of the beautiful things that are used to express the goodness and beauty of the Lord are some of the poems that have been written in the past. And so you will hear a few of them as we progress. We are born. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life star, has had elsewhere its setting and comes from afar, not in entire forgetfulness, not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. And certainly that's what Genesis says, that God created man in his image to be able to do like he does, create things, and to understand him and understand his purposes. Ecclesiastes comments, interestingly, "If a man lives many years, and his soul not be filled with good, an untimely birth is better than he." Peter said, "Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good." So we are born to be successful. Somebody commented that you are successful if you're careful in the choice of your grandparents. And you know how the genealogies of the Old Testament and the New sometimes go way back to the very earliest of ancestors, showing how very important that is. What we really become depends on our heredity, our environment, and our response. And it depends, of course, on our brain. We're born with billions of nerve cells, but in two different places it was stated that we lose 100,000 every day. And so some of you can take consolation in the fact that you don't remember everything, because some of those nerve cells that you once connected to names have been lost. So we're born once to enter the kingdom of man, but we have to be born again to enter the kingdom of heaven. One of the hymns says what we are like before we realize the salvation that we needed and that we have as we are born again. My soul is night, my heart is steel, I cannot see, I cannot feel. For light, for life, I must appeal in simple faith to Jesus. He died, he lives, he reigns, he pleads. There's love in all his works and deeds. There's all a guilty sinner needs forevermore in Jesus. Though some should sneer and some should blame, I'll go with all my guilt and shame to. I'll go to him because his name, above all names, is Jesus. So, he who has begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. And so we are born, and after that we need an education. Remember, Jesus grew in wisdom in those years before he became a prominent speaker. A skeptic about education says a college education is a four-year loaf composed of the flour of youth and the dough of old age, and it might be true in some cases. And another skeptic said that education is inculcating the inscrutable into the ignorant by the incompetent. And teachers have been defined as people who talk in other people's sleep. But education in college won't hurt anybody if he's willing to learn something afterwards. And that comes by much reading. Reading makes a full man, somebody has said. The Harper Library at the University of Chicago has a motto over its entrance: read neither to believe nor to doubt, but to weigh and consider. The Apostle Paul wrote, there are many voices or languages in the world, and none is without meaning or significance, but know that their meaning is to build up the church. So our education should be a factor in our ability to be proper members of a church. So the basic reason for a Christian education is to build up the church. The word education itself is not used in Scripture, but the words learning and learn are mentioned a number of times. Jesus said, learn of me, for I am weak, I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your soul. One of the marks of an educated man, and that was the name of the book, is he asks the one who knows. And so obviously we ask the words of Scripture given by men who knew Christ and knew what he wanted. Paul Harvey spoke in chapel here one time, and he said, don't be average. Average is the best of the lousiest and the lousiest of the best. Will Rogers said, everybody's ignorant, but only on different things. Somebody by the name of McKenna commented, evangelical students do not have sufficient understanding, undergirding, of an examined, critical, discriminating faith to hold them through the rest of their lives. But I venture that the college near you certainly does not undermine people, but helps them to really have an integration between all the phases of knowledge and of life. You've heard speaking from this pulpit here, not only the president of the college, but the physiologist, the psychologist, and very recently the historian at the college, and you realize that they do integrate the knowledge they have with their Christian life. Ed Hicks used to be up here and then at Trinity and other places, and he wrote once, "We have to recognize the Lordship of Christ to integrate our faith, our learning, and our life, to know that all truth is God's truth, whether it comes from the scriptures or from the research that people have made. And then we have to construct a value system and be sensitive to the priority of human beings. Progress is made in knowledge in our education when we see what everyone has seen and think what no one has thought." Now, that was said one time when Amoco, at its new building near Naperville, had a conference to talk about the kind of research that they wanted to do. And one of the illustrations is the discovery of penicillin. Most everybody had seen a mold similar to penicillin, and everybody knows bacteria exist. But the man who, Alexander Fleming, discovered how penicillin could be an antibiotic, realized that if the mold prevented bacteria growing in a tube outside of the body, penicillin could be given to a person to counteract the bacteria that are living within him. He saw what everybody had seen and thought something that nobody had thought. Well, after school, some people make a good living, but a poor life. There's on record a millionaire who committed suicide because he could think of nothing more that he wanted to seek or do. Jesus said, "A man's life does not consist in the things which he possesses." So Elizabeth Harvey commented, "Happiness is belonging, not belongings." Is life worth living? It depends on the liver. That's true physiologically as well as in living. "What man is there who desires life?" It says in Psalm 34. "And covets many days that he may enjoy good?" And the answer is, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. George Eliot, famous novelist, wrote Middlemarch, and the last sentence says, "The reason life is not half so ill with most of us is largely owing to those who have lived faithfully hidden lives and rest in unvisited tombs. Our being is more important than just our accomplishments, our belongings, but our relationship to many other people. Friends are the only things you can take with you from this life. So we learn to love. Love had a mother's hands and eyes when I was a child. Love taught me comfort, soothed my sighs, with gifts beguiled. Love was the urgent surge of spring when I was young, a lyric that told of a magic thing and still my tongue. Now, love appears as a way to live, a subtle art, a glad heart, rising to greet and give to another heart." Will Rogers said, "I joked about every prominent man, but I never met a man I didn't like." And that's what's important. Then, of course, marriage comes along. "Marriage is honorable in all," is the scripture statement from Hebrews. And a lady named Helen Rowland, but she spells it R-O-W-L-A-N-D, but I'm sure our Mrs. Rowland could quote valuable things too. Helen Rowland said, "Marriage is like eating with chopsticks. It looks easy until you try it." Robert Louis Stevenson commented, "Marriage is a long conversation interrupted by disputes." And the former president Buswell at the college commented one time in one of his messages, "You can love anybody physically, but it's important to love a person spiritually and intellectually. The person that you're going to converse with three meals a day for a good bit of your life." So that's what's important. Genesis certainly approved the first marriage of Adam and Eve. George Wald, one of the Nobel Prize winners, said, "Genesis is right. It leads up to the climax of all creation, woman." And of course, that relationship with woman is so very important. A critic, a skeptic again, said, "If you're single, remember some of the worst men haters are married women. They have more reason." And Dr. Tenney, who taught Bible at the college for many years, "The Pilgrim mothers put up with everything that the Pilgrim fathers put up with, and also with the Pilgrim fathers." So some of you know what we're talking about there. But we are married for better or for worse, and also for good. It just happens that this week, wife and I have been married 59 years. Well, we have to prepare for trouble. Job said, "Man is born under trouble as the sparks fly upward." Somebody said, "Nobody ever promised you a rose garden." So we have to be mentally prepared for the troubles that may come. Remember Kipling, "Learn to meet with triumph and disaster and treat both those impostors just the same." One of my guiding professors in graduate work named Campmeyer, he loved to write poetry. But one time I complained that I was having trouble with a certain kind of technique, and he said, "Don't think you're the only person who had this kind of trouble." So various difficulties arise before all of us. C.S. Lewis is famous for these words, "God whispers in our pleasures, God speaks in our conscience, but God shouts in our pain." And so Psalm 46 says, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the world is shaken. So be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted in heaven, I will be exalted in all the earth." The God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulations, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the same comfort wherewith we are comforted of God. Certainly Paul, who wrote that, knew what he was talking about, for perhaps he, more than anybody else, suffered for his Christian faith. Then any of us have the opportunity of prayer. And so many things have been written about prayer. And it's easier, I guess, to memorize things about prayer than to obey what they say. But Archbishop Trent had that very famous prevailing prayer sonnet. "Lord, what a change within us one short hour spent in thy presence will avail to make. What heavy burdens from our bosoms take, what parched grounds refresh as with a shower. We kneel, and all around us seems to lower. We rise, and all the distant and the near stands forth in sunny outline, brave and clear. We kneel how weak, we rise how full of power. Why therefore should we do ourselves this wrong or others that we're not always strong? That we are ever overborne with care, that we should ever weak or heartless be, anxious or troubled, when with us is prayer and joy and strength and courage are with thee. More things are wrought by prayer than this world dreams of. Wherefore, let your voice rise night and day, that the answers may be given to us that can come by the prayer that we know. One of the great prayers offered is called Others. Lord, help me live from day to day in such a self-forgetful way that even when I kneel to pray, my prayer shall be for others. Help me in all the work I do to ever be sincere and true, and know that all I do for you must need be done for others. And when my work on earth is done and my new work in heaven begun, may I forget the crown I've won while thinking still of others. Others, Lord, yes, others. Let this my prayer be. Help me to live for others, and I will live like thee. We have to avoid pride in our lives. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. So we clothe ourselves with humility, for God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. The city financier walked in his garden stiffly because of his pride and his burdens. The flower, looking up, observed only a self-respecting curve. The thrushes saw only a flat tableland of shiny hat. He looked importantly about him, and all the world went on without him. So, let someone else blow your horn. It'll be heard a lot farther. And we grow old. Let me grow lovely, growing old. So many fine things new. Laces, ivory, gold, silk need not be new. There's healing in old trees, old streets a glamour hold. Why may not I, as well as these, grow lovely, growing old? So live that when thy summons comes to join that innumerable caravan that moves its way to dusty death, thou go sustained and soothed by an unfaltering trust, and you can wrap the draperies of your couch about you and lie down pleasant dreams. Whittier said, I know not what the future hath of marvel or surprise, assured alone that life or death God's mercy underlies. And so many blessings undeserved have marked my erring path, that wheresoever my feet have swerved, his chastening turned me back. But more and more a providence of love is understood, making the springs of time and sense sweet with eternal good. I know not where his islands lift their fronded palms in air. I know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. So the psalmist comments, O God, from my youth thou hast taught me, and I still proclaim thy wondrous deeds. So even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me till I proclaim thy might to all the generations to come. So the poet has prayed. Drop thy still dews of quietness till all our striving cease. Take from our lives the strain and stress, and may our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace. My brother Brad has selected a hymn for us that we'll sing as our concluding number.